This is the Lou Rockwell Show.
What an honor it is today to have Naomi Wolf with us. Ms. Wolf is author of 7 books, an outspoken defender of liberty, especially in this era of the Bush administration. And in her last book, The End of America, she laid out the path to fascism that America's been taking in these most recent years. Naomi, tell us about just how far are we down that path?
Wow. Well, you know, the answer to that changes day by day, and it especially changes depending on how many Americans are waking up and taking action. But since I wrote The End of America, since it came out last fall, I think last fall we were at sort of a quarter to midnight, and really in the last 2 weeks we're a few minutes past midnight, in the sense that while we still obviously have all the structures of civil society in place, while we still obviously have nominal elections and a judiciary and newspapers publishing, we also have seen the last kind of two steps put in place by the administration, which leads us one action step away from martial law. And I've been saying since October 1st that technically a coup has occurred, and let me tell you exactly what I mean. It's a Rovian coup, so it's very slow motion and incremental. But on October 1st, the last step of the 10 steps to fascism is that the executive or the leader makes it easier to declare martial law and starts to simply subvert the rule of law. So for a year I've been warning people about the Defense Authorization Act of 2007, which gives the president the power to simply declare a national emergency because he says so, and then he can federalize the National Guard or deploy Blackwater in a basically a state of martial law. Well, he doesn't even have to do that right now because he, with a signing statement, subverted limitations that Congress tried to put on the Defense Authorization Act, and thus did an end run around posse comitatus, which has protected us, along with the Insurrection Act, for 200 years from the prospect of soldiers on our streets. And now he's deployed the 1st Brigade of the 3rd Infantry Division from Iraq to somewhere in the United States of America. So while we haven't seen soldiers on our streets or stationed outside our polling places or stationed outside or inside the halls of Congress, as a student of history, it is very alarming that he's done this, because it's got many, many implications that we might not see at first, or we might not want to believe at first. But there definitely, if he, moves further, which he can, since they're answerable to him and not to Congress, not to the governors, not to the people. They have to answer to him. Once the troops are deployed, it doesn't matter what people think or feel. We're not in democracy time anymore. We're really in a state of emergency where we don't have time to deliberate. We don't have time to file lawsuits. We don't have time to, vote the bums out, because things happen at a much accelerated pace.
Well, it's extraordinary that Americans still continue to think we're the freest country in the world. Fascism, of course, has been so long an epithet that people maybe forget that it's an actual political philosophy. And we have the militarism, the belligerent nationalism, the leader principle, the suppression of civil liberties, all the rest of the marks, as you've written, of a fascist state. And yet Americans still, don't you think most Americans still think of this as the freest country in the world, quite crazily?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and it's kind of for a good reason. I think that Karl Rove, I have no smoking gun that it's him, but many reasons to believe that he's kind of the evil genius behind this. Someone influential in this administration has studied history, and what's so brilliant about the way they're setting up an infrastructure of a police state is that they're doing it kind of behind a Disneyland facade of democracy. And a constitutional republic. And by the way, I want to give a shout out to libertarians who have educated me that I must be careful in my wording and remind people that we're a constitutional republic, or we're supposed to be. So they're really kind of moving. It's like the Wizard of Oz. It's like, don't look at the man behind the curtain. We're being directed certainly to pay attention to a celebrity culture and a consumer culture while it lasts, but we're also directed at a kind of what I've discovered in Give Me Liberty to be a kind of fake patriotism. We've been I learned, bombarded with 30 years of a mythology messaging about fake patriotism in order to get us to accept what I've discovered is, in many ways, a fake democracy. You know, that there have been obstacles put in the way of the citizen leadership that I discovered from my research in Give Me Liberty. The founders really, and by that I mean the whole founding generation, ordinary people as well as well-known ones, wanted us as Americans to show. So, yeah, we're being constantly told this is the freest nation on earth, this is the strongest democracy on earth. Meanwhile, I discovered that, you know, our elections are such a mess that Jimmy Carter's Carter Center we don't even qualify as one of the nations in the developing world. We're not as improved in our election process as developing world nations to qualify to get the Carter Center to monitor our vote or other independent monitors to watch our vote. I discovered other things. You know, we're told that any American can run for office. Well, I tried to put in place a number of those promises that the founders meant for American citizens to be able to make good on. And there's a section in the book where I'm, like, trying to get a friend to run for Senate in Virginia, and I find out that the information we need is kind of locked away in this language that's entirely impenetrable, and there are no resources to find out how to translate it to avoid getting arrested, you know, to avoid getting in trouble with the FEC if we move forward. You know, there's, like, this other place where I try to hold a rally in Union Square in support of the Constitution, and, you know, 15 minutes in, I learned that what I'm doing is illegal because it's a crime to stage a rally in a public place in New York using a bullhorn, because there's been this silent over-permitization process for 30 years that I had no idea about to keep us from using our First Amendment rights of speech and assembly. And on, I think about registering my neighbors to vote, and I discover I could be risking a $5,000 fine if I, you know, get a name spelled wrong, because unfortunately this is mostly Republican, but it would be just as despicable from any group. There's this sustained effort to criminalize, you know, and penalize voter registration and the voting process. I went through this whole set of blocks, this whole kind of armature of this fake democracy, and I discovered that, you know, the one place where they welcomed my service to my country with open arms and the whole process was transparent and supportive and written in clear English was when I went into an Army recruiting station and tried to find out about the process of serving in the war in Iraq. We have to wake the people up to understanding that we're being, deliberately propagandized and brainwashed to accept a more and more limited role as citizens, and really messaging to make us give up our seat at the table, because it serves the vested interests who are threatened by citizens knowing how to use their rights, their liberties, and knowing how practically and powerfully to organize to defend them.
As a libertarian, I've long been disdainful of conservatives and their promotion of war and the police state, even going back to Bill Buckley in the 1950s. But I remember being astounded, even I, as cynical as I can be, astounded in the Reagan years, and it certainly has accelerated since then, that when these people say America, or when they refer to somebody as being anti-American, by America they mean the presidential state, the warfare state, the spying state. When they say you're anti-American, they mean you're differing with U.S. foreign policy and U.S. domestic security policy.
That's very well put.
So it's an alarm. I say another alarming trend. Certainly, this is no longer a free country by the standards of the founders, or even more recent standards.
Certainly not by the standards of the founders. And can you educate me a little more, please? Because obviously, I guess I'm learning. I'm on a learning curve where I'm discovering that while I was raised kind of on the progressive side, just because of where I was born and where I grew up, and you know, my demographic, I think I've been a secret libertarian for many years in many, many ways. Do you have a working definition that you like of libertarian? And can you share it with me? And also, why aren't more conservatives and more libertarians challenging this kind of hijacking of the meaning of Americanness?
Well, libertarians, in one sense, are people who agree with Lord Acton that the highest political virtue is liberty. And it's the view that voluntary society is morally and practically the best form of society, and that the state is, as Murray put it, a gang of thieves writ large. The state is able to do all those things that are illegal and properly illegal for us in private society. It's able to do them and have us think that it's actually in the common good and the national interest or the common defense and all the rest of the words that the government schools teach us early on and the government-connected media tell us about. Another way of putting libertarianism in a nutshell is that the state is not above the moral law. What's wrong for you and me in private life is wrong for the state, so it's wrong for us to steal. They can't call it taxation. It's wrong for us to kidnap. They can't call it the draft. It's wrong, you know, just down the line.
Who would disagree with these? I mean, this is such a reasonable set of positions.
Well, I think more and more people are agreeing with it, and I think the fact that there are progressives like yourself who are joining with real libertarians to fight what I called a number of years ago red state fascism is, I think, a very heartening and a very thrilling thing. I think
it is a thrilling thing. And can I just
yes,
jump
please.
In and say to reassure people, or I guess what I'm trying to say is I do feel accountable to answer a lot of questions that are arising from the libertarian community about sort of, am I just as concerned about blue state fascism? And I just want to say it right now that I am just as concerned about blue state fascism because, you know, clearly these problems are not going to go away. You know, if a Democrat or a Republican is elected, these are not partisan issues. These are issues that are not going to be addressed unless there's a citizens movement that is transpartisan that understands that we're up against a corporatized, you know, gang of special interests manifesting as this sort of semblance of, you know, this parade or charade of democracy.
No, and of course we do live in a corporatist state, and we're in this economic crisis that the Federal Reserve brought about through the vast monetary expansion that took place under Alan Greenspan and George Bush. And now we have a crisis, and of course in a crisis is when the state, as historian Robert and economist Robert Higgs points out, that's when the state can really expand. And so we have that, but on the other hand, we have, thanks to you and thanks to many other intellectuals, we have a far more educated group of dissidents. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in some sense, this is our moment to try to teach about the importance of freedom and the evil of fascism.
It is our moment, but I do need to ask you again to educate me about two things, and forgive my, you know, I'm trying to amass a huge amount of new information very quickly, and the trouble with partisanship in our country and the way it manifests is that we're, especially with the internet, paradoxically, is that we're very much in bubbles of information, and so things that are well known to a libertarian community, people in a progressive bubble may never have heard. For instance, believe it or not, this critique of the Federal Reserve, I've never been immersed in it in a rigorous way or a sustained way. So I guess I'd like you to tell me what I should know about your reading of the bailout. And I'm sorry to be interviewing you. I
know no, it's
you
thrilling.
Know, I should have it be mutual. But I'd like to understand that. And I guess I'd also like to understand, per your last set of remarks, if we had a real working republic, a real citizen-driven consent of the governed, functional republic, would you still see the state so negatively?
Well, let me say, first of all, I frankly have never understood why people on the left are not upset about the Federal Reserve. If you look back,
just don't understand it.
But the founding of the Fed before the law was bipartisan support signed in 1913, the Federal Reserve Act was drafted at J.P. Morgan's private club. It sounds like a conspiracy story, but of course, I guess it sort of is. In Jekyll Island, Georgia, it involved Nelson Aldrich, John D. Rockefeller's son-in-law. Big bankers wrote the Federal Reserve Act for their benefit. And ever since Nixon freed the Federal Reserve from any restraints on it whatsoever when he what was called closed the gold window, and we've had an entirely discretionary monetary policy, meaning for the benefit of the big banks and other special interests. This time, however, they have really done it to us, because while the Federal Reserve, when it emits these vast amounts of new money through the banking system, brings about the business cycle, it causes an artificial boom, as happened recently with housing and in many other areas, that caused the biggest bubble in world history, probably the biggest bust.
Mm-hmm.
So the Federal Reserve is a special interest operation that works in league to benefit the government and the big banks and the military-industrial complex and all the bad guys in American society.
Well, how would this implosion serve them? I mean, surely they could have foreseen that this policy would not be good for them.
Well, you know, it's a little bit like it actually does not serve them, but their arrogance and their feeling that they were masters of the universe. I guess they felt that they could do whatever they wanted to do and there wouldn't be any consequences. But there are economic laws, and certain actions bring about certain results. And there's nothing, so no, they did not bring this on deliberately. They're very unhappy about this. They're scared about it. And of course, their response is to rip off every regular American for the big guys on Wall Street and the big banks all over the country, but especially the New York banks, that whole complex, ever since the New York Fed, the New York banks, the big guys on Wall Street. It's like everything else in the government, the Defense Department, so-called, or whatever, it's a ripoff. But yes, if we, from a personal standpoint, if we had a, you know, a republic of the sort that the framers had drafted, no, of course I would feel less antagonistic towards it. I actually am in favor of the Articles of Confederation, which was a much more libertarian document than the Constitution. But anything that would bring us back towards more limited government, of course, I'd be thrilled by it. But I would never ever be in favor of a monopoly institution that claims the right to use force against you and to take your money and to decide how much of your money they need to do what they want to do, and they have a monopoly. And another way to think about what libertarianism is that it's never justified to use force or the threat of force against the innocent. Now, of course, everybody would say, well, of course, right. I agree with that, but in fact, they don't agree with it. Therefore, regulations, taxations, inflation, all the rest of the things that go on that are a matter of force. Mm-hmm. So, we believe in a voluntary society, and we're being ripped off by the government and by these institutions in league with the governments and by the power elite in league with the government. So
okay, so I get, this is a very helpful primer for me, but I have the same question to you that it's funny how left and right kind of come together in, you know, at certain points on the spectrum where people are set up, because this analysis of society I also hear from the anarchist left. And my question to them, or the kind of the post-capitalist left, and my question to them is, well, how do you organize a complex modern state under such idealistic circumstances? And I guess I would put the same question to you.
Well, you wouldn't have a state. I mean, that's, of course, first of all. But how would you organize, say, a complex modern society? I think.
How would you organize America?
Well, first of all, America would be this geographical location. There wouldn't be that horrible business in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And I think that people do indeed organize themselves. Mm-hmm. There are many complex institutions of nonprofit sort, of for-profit sort, of in all areas of society that are organized without the state. And in fact, the state is a parasitical institution that wrecks society, and that really human society is self-organizing, that in terms of the market, in terms of our social relations, that you actually don't have to have a state, and that indeed a state is a problem.
So interesting. So this is almost, sounds very 18th century. I mean that as a compliment. I mean, it's like the most idealistic writers, they were kind of teasing out the implications of human freedom and you know, why is it ideal for human beings to have freedom and why can we trust that? They also believed that if human beings were given freedom, the human inclination is to organize, you know, for the greatest good voluntarily, and that force is always wrong.
Yes, in fact, there's an interesting passage in Jefferson where he says that he's always been interested in the Indians because they don't have government. And he unfortunately didn't study that, maybe a little, although he was one of the more libertarian, of course, of the framers.
So interesting. Well, then what would you do? I mean, I think one reason the left doesn't take on the Federal Reserve, I was kind of joking when I said we don't get it, but I'm not really joking. We're very unsophisticated about financial matters and economic issues for a lot of ideological reasons. But that said, what would you replace it with?
I think the market would replace it with gold, is my guess. I mean, money came into existence as a market institution. It wasn't an invention of government. Really, there's been nothing any good that was invented by government. Mass war, genocide, this sort of thing is, of course, invented by government. But then in the market, money developed as the most liquid commodity, so that people chose gold and silver freely. Then government, in effect, nationalized it. King stamped his face on it and started to fool with it and to inflate it. This has been true. All throughout history, and you mentioned before, why would the power elite, the Fed, and have caused this crisis deliberately? And I don't think they did, but you know, it's a little bit like if you had a counterfeiting press in your basement. If I had a counterfeiting press in my basement, you would know it's immoral to use it, but there would certainly be a big temptation.
Big temptation.
Well, the federal government has got a gigantic counterfeiting press called the Federal Reserve, and they used it more than they, even by their own standards, they ought to have. They've brought about probably a worldwide depression. So it's, you know, time for us to talk about why these institutions are evil, moral evil, economically evil, politically evil,
and
talk against fascism and do the kind of work that you've been doing so extraordinarily.
Thank you. Well, so again, not to keep peppering you with questions, but if the Federal Reserve is a private entity and it's not regulated, you know, it's not. How can I put this? What recourse do citizens have in challenging the Federal Reserve?
Well, it's an illegitimate institution. I mean, it's like saying, if we didn't have a government CIA, would we have a private CIA? No, we wouldn't. I mean, it's entirely illegitimate. Nobody but a government would engage in what the CIA does. And the Federal Reserve is entirely an illegitimate organization. So there would be no private Federal Reserve. Such a thing can only exist at the behest of and in cooperation with the state.
I do understand that. I guess I'm asking a different question. Let me try it again. What I'm very focused these days on practical steps that citizens can take, and what I'm hoping will create as a transpartisan army. Like, clearly the battle lines have to be redrawn. I mean, clearly, you know, I learn more about this every day. It's the people across party lines, the people who've kind of woken up to the subversion of their liberties and this kind of evil structure that is, you know, this sort of vile marriage of corporate interests and state interests and, you know, military-industrial interests and so on. So in building that army, I keep looking at, well, what can we do? What are our action steps? What are our pressure points? And the Federal Reserve is so powerful and so kind of beyond recourse by ordinary citizens. I'm wondering, what is there any action step that we can take to challenge this kind of hegemony, or even get people practically to think critically about how it's doing its business?
Well, I think,
like, what recourse do we have as citizens is sort of what I'm asking.
Well, I think the first step is to educate yourself. So I would think, you know, little books, very easy to read books like The Case Against the Fed by Murray Rothbard, mm-hmm. is one good way. But first, you have to sort of withdraw your intellectual consent. You have to learn about the fact that you're being ripped off. There's a reason that the Fed is never mentioned in any of the discussions these days about the economic crisis, that it's Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, maybe it's people lending too much, or poor people got mortgages they should have gotten, whatever the reasons
so
that are...
I'm mad when I hear that.
The reasons that are being held out. But none of this could have taken place without the agency of the Federal Reserve. But it's true, you're not supposed to be actually interested in this organization. You're supposed to be bored by it. Maybe it's the name on the bills
exactly
in your
right.
pocket. You're not supposed
exactly
to know. But
right.
the reason you're not supposed to know is because you are being ripped off to an unbelievable extent. And the trillions and trillions of dollars of new credit they're creating right now for the benefit of the banksters is going to cause just tremendous depredations on the American people and people all over the world, and you're not supposed to know about it. So the first thing is know about it. Read about
it. Right, right.
It's a fascinating story of special interest and special interest ripoff. And I've argued, in fact, that the government could have never fought the wars it's fought without the Federal Reserve. There's a reason that debates over the budget were never a question when Bush wanted another $100 billion, another $150 billion to murder people in Iraq or Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. It's never a debate because they don't have to tax anybody for this. They just print it. But this has certain things follow from this.
Right.
And we're seeing right now this depression is one of the things that follow. And I also want to credit you on what you said about this sort of crazy partisanship. Really, the two parties are just, you know, wings of the same bird of prey, as Butler Schaefer says. And we're supposed to fight them. The Republicans fight the Democrats mm-hmm. fight the Republicans. But we're supposed to ignore the guy behind the curtain who's actually doing so much damage to all of us.
Exactly. You're completely right. I mean, I often tell audiences that when I'm invited on these kind of national debate shows, they, as you well know, the producer will, you know, do a pre-interview and basically say, don't agree with the other side. You know? And if they present the other side's position, I say something like, well, that sounds reasonable, or there's certainly a nugget of truth in that observation. I'll be given in no uncertain terms the instruction that, you know, that's not good television. In fact, I just was on Fox News this morning, and Fox and Friends, and the producer said before cameras were rolling, remember, you don't have to like each other. So there's this kind of, you know, machine set up really on both sides to generate, you know, people screaming at each other and characterizing, caricaturing each other's positions. And I've got a whole chapter on deliberation in Give Me Liberty, because the founders really wanted citizens to be the ones leading the debates, and especially citizens who disagreed with one another, to know how to sit down together respectfully and, you know, educate each other and challenge each other, because you get better policy outcomes that way. They didn't intend for pundits and a whole kind of corporate punditocracy to hijack the debate process. And, you know, one of these core values that makes America so precious when it's working as it should is that, unlike citizens in the rest of the world, we're supposed to be able to disagree without violence. But I'm very, I'm very concerned that these kind of two mountains of embedded partisanship with the, you know, institutes and the think tanks and the media outlets that all thrive on us hating and caricaturing each other, are really just going to escalate, you know, the partisanship into worse. You know, this campaign is like a new low. And certainly I'm now convinced that this partisanship and this name-calling keeps us from organizing in our numbers, because one thing we have going for us, of course, is our numbers, to direct our attention at the people who are our common enemy, our common antagonist. I believe that more than ever now.
And the role of the corporate punditocracy is to make sure that the real issues are never discussed. We never discuss the empire. We never discuss the police state. We don't discuss the wars. We don't discuss the Fed. We don't discuss what's going on in the economic crisis. It's just a bunch of things that actually are either of irrelevance or very little relevance. But that's their job.
You're completely right. I mean, I can't get over how right you are. Again, I'd love to ask you about kind of the psychological process of kind of waking up to this reality behind the reality, because it's very painful. I mean, I'm finding it painful. You know, many of my friends are in the corporate media, and I'm in that world. I hang out there, you know, as well as hanging out, thank God, among sort of normal American citizens. But what is very scary to me is that I was reluctant to accept how much of a blackout there is in the corporate media, because none of my friends who works in that world gets a memo saying, don't cover, you know, the Constitution, or don't address where the 1st Brigade deployed. But I think I've really been in denial, because just in the last few months, there are stories going on right now that are so obviously newsworthy. Like, I'm finding I'm in this bizarre situation of people asking me where the 1st Brigade is deployed, and I'm saying to my friends at the New York Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer, hello, can you please send some investigative reporters to do some real reporting on this? And, you know, and then I go on the Today Show, and my questions are framed as dangerous radicalism, you know, whereas people across the country are concerned that there are troops being deployed and want to know what's real reporting on it versus what's Army Times spin. So I can no longer ignore the fact that, you know, veterans, I was just addressed by a wonderful young man, a 24-year-old Iraq war vet, and he and his fellow veterans went to the gates of the presidential debate in New Jersey, the last presidential debate, wanting to ask rightly, why are veterans' affairs not being addressed? And the war, you know, not being addressed properly. And they were, a police officer, met, you know, on a horse, rode his horse into the crowd and trampled this young veteran so badly that his cheekbones were broken. And yet this brave young man was right there at Barnes & Noble the next day, you know, speaking up again. I mean, that kind of do as American patriots, all of us. But I have to hand it to you. There is a giant blackout right now in the media on these core issues. And I that's why I call and Give Me Liberty, but we need to build it and expand it so much on ordinary citizens to kind of withdraw their crediting of the mainstream media with authority and start becoming their own journalists and generating their own media. And, you know, for instance, I teach people to write op-eds and leak to reporters and frame feature stories and so on. But I have to say, I agree with you now.
I have a friend who was a Russian economist, now lives in this country, and he said that during the bailout mania, when you had the entire American media campaigning for the bailout in a hysterical and unrelenting fashion, that he was reminded of Pravda and Izvestia in the old days of the Soviet Union. He said the only difference was no Russian with a brain believed anything they read in Pravda and Izvestia, but the Americans seemed to believe the American media.
Well, let's go back to that question then about the psychological journey, because it is really painful to wake up to the fact that, you know, the free press that you thought was working adequately is wholly owned, and that, you know, your republic that you thought was kind of minimally at least limping along, you know, is largely being run by puppet masters. I mean, how do people deal with that? There's the process.
Well, you know, I guess you have to take the red pill, I mean, in one sense, but it's absolutely true that you never again think, or if the Matrix, you never again think the same way about everything. You can see through all the government propaganda. It's a great thing to know the truth. And once you do understand that, you know, we live in, this is the biggest, richest, most powerful government ever to exist in the history of the world, the U.S. government, engaged in vast redistribution. We, the Republicans, are talking about redistribution now. Of course, everything the government does is redistributive. They're okay if the money's going to Lockheed, but, you know, that's redistribution, right. Redistribution too. So we have this vast state, a vast world empire, and you just have to come to the conclusion, which I think you do if you start to read and think about it, that everything they say to us is a lie. I mean, my own rule of thumb is, believe every, you know, the opposite of everything the government says. I'm not always right, but I'm pretty much always right. And that includes the, you know, the media that's in cahoots with the government. It includes much of the academic world. It includes, you know, a lot of public intellectuals, with a few heroic exceptions like you. You know, but once you see through it, once you realize that the government has its own motives, the government is not actually interested in the common good or the public good. The government is a parasite on the rest of society, and it benefits itself, and it benefits those agencies and institutions that are in cahoots with it in private society, but that it's not, they're not actually out for the common good. They don't actually care about our freedom. In fact, it's just the opposite. They're the enemy of our freedom. They're the enemy of our economic well-being. And again, I think that if in a crisis like the one we're in, the economic crisis, which I'm afraid is going to get worse, one good thing about that sort of a situation is radical change is possible. All of a sudden, people become open to radical ideas. You mentioned before dangerous radicalism. Well, of course, this is dangerous only to the bad guys. It's not dangerous to the cause of freedom. And so I actually am optimistic as I see more and more people interested, for example, in the Federal Reserve, more and more people opposed to the wars and to the empire. Mm-hmm. I think in this crisis, they're going to try to extract even more money from us through taxes and inflation for all their various schemes. But I think there's going to be a lot of opposition. I think we've got an interesting few years ahead of us, and it sure is a great thing that you're out there speaking and writing and telling the truth.
Well, I do, you know, thank you for your kind words, but let me stress that, a couple of things. It's pretty nerve-wracking out here. I mean, now that I think some of the things we're saying are really kind of making a greater impact, the level of hate speech directed, you know, at me, at my message, you know, online, for instance, is really going through the roof. And so also just knowing what I know about closing societies, well, it's nice to have people like you and me and, you know, our various colleagues across the spectrum out there kind of beating the drum. We're not going to all be safest until, you know, millions of us are out there. And that is what is called for, you know, closing society. You can't kind of leave it to anyone but a collective consciousness to shift. So I did want to say that. And it could be just that, you know, I'm a mother of two children. So if I were childless, I'd probably be kind of out there on the barricades going, you know, bring it on. But instead, I'm out there on the barricades going, please join me, you know.
Well, of course that's right.
All.
No, I'm a father, too, and I agree with that. And I had a friend recently write me and said, don't worry, I'm going to send you oranges when you're in the FEMA camp.
No, oh, God.
So, yeah, of course, we all, there's no question this is a very frightening and desperate situation. But what's our choice? Our choice is either
to go along
or we have to fight it.
We have no choice. And that, thank you for prompting me to say that. I mean, one thing I'm always telling audiences, and I know it's true, is that people have a very mistaken idea from having not lived in an actual police state, that if you just keep your head down, you'll be okay. But that's a very dangerous delusion, that there is no safety in a police state. I just want to remind people, it doesn't matter if you've voted, you know, with the regime your whole life, or if you're, you know, a wholehearted evangelical, it doesn't matter. There's no safety in a police state through silence. The only safety is when millions of citizens challenge and take action against this closing down. But there are two more things I want to say about what you just said before. Okay, I believe that people who share, you know, your worldview and the worldview that I'm increasingly kind of feeling sympathetic toward, are very good at critical analysis, but I see less practical recommendations for action. And, of course, I've made some, you know, movements in that direction with the last third of the book, which are these 55 action steps. But do you ever want your kind of team, your supporters, to be more proactive about, okay, well, you know, here it comes, what do we do about it?
Well, I think that, you know, in effect, part of the division of labor, some people are more engaged in intellectual work, others more in activism, and I don't think these are at all opposed, but at least my own role is to try to make people understand what's going on. Sometimes I think political action is actually, you know, very much of a negative, and buying into the system, and it really doesn't make a huge difference which of these parties is elected to power. The same economic groups, I mean, Barack Obama's largest donor is Goldman Sachs. I mean, he's the Wall, you know, we've got Wall Street candidate A and Wall Street candidate B. So to sort of throw yourself into one side of the partisan thing seems to me a mistake. On the other hand,
no, of course, but what about creating a movement that
absolutely
restores power to
yes,
people.
Magnificent. Yes, absolutely. Organizing, writing, speaking, and changing people's minds. I think minds are being changed. I think people are, I think back to a similar economic period in, you know, in the early 1930s, virtually nobody understood what was going on, what had happened. Now a lot of people do understand what's going on, and there's a lot more opposition to the welfare state, to the warfare state, to the Wall Street state, and I think we all have, but absolutely, activism in the form of organizational, and even, you know, I mean, when Ron Paul ran for president, I thought that was a magnificent thing.
Something that came to me a couple of days ago from a reader. He gave me a couple of pages of the actual text of the bailout bill, which has now been passed. And nobody has covered this, and I had no idea about it, but it made permanent forever, unless it's repealed, a provision that the IRS can now show, you know, information about anyone to any government agency. You know, like they can take my returns and show them to, you know, the Justice Department or the FBI. You know, without any notification, if I understand this correctly. It was just, like, buried in there. And that kind of thing also contextualized to me, like, why the franticness, why the urgency, why the threats, if we're going to believe Brad Sherman, who said on C-SPAN that individual members of the House were, presumably by the White House, being told that if they didn't pass the bailout bill, there would be, quote-unquote, martial law in America. Again, I'm a reporter, so, that he said it. It's on C-SPAN. I haven't seen a second source confirm it. But certainly there was a great deal of urgency, and now we're stuck with this, and it's had no coverage. So a Constitution Party could be a pressure group to block, to challenge, to penalize leaders who collude with that kind of, treacherous behavior.
Certainly also this bill gives the IRS all new powers to set up front organizations, front businesses, and to trick people and entrap people so that the IRS can now, for example, set up a tax, you know, an H&R Block kind of a company where they do tax preparation. They can then suggest to you that, hey, you know, you really don't have to pay these taxes. You can do this and so, and then arrest you when you go along.
Oh, my God. So you had heard about this.
Oh, yeah. And there's many horrible things in this bill, just like in the Patriot Act, right? These kinds of situations, they've had their wish list for a long time, these people within the state. And then they use the crisis to, pass vast expansions of power for themselves. But there's horrific, horrific stuff in this. You know, it went from 3 pages to, 453 pages.
Right.
And what's in there is not all nice things. I hate to shock anybody's sense of civics as they were taught in elementary school. But the government is, you know, not for the public interest. It's opposed to the public interest. It's, in fact, the enemy of the American people. And everything they do, especially during a crisis like this, is evil with a capital E. The actual axis of evil is, you know, the judiciary, the Congress, and the presidency.
Well, it definitely reframes who our most urgent enemies are and who the most serious bad guys are. I mean, what I've been saying to people for some time now is, you know, it's very interesting that the Times reported this morning, and, you know, certainly we can have our questions about the Times, but some of their reporting on these issues is still sound. They reported that the former head of MI5 in Britain, Stella Rimington, I believe is her name, was saying that the U.S. approach to terrorism is very counterproductive and that she and others in Britain are calling for a rollback of the kind of surveillance society, stripping of habeas corpus society that had been going along in a mission creep, you know, the way, certainly the way ours has, and that she is calling for restoring civil liberties and you know, democratic processes as being the best safeguard against terrorism. And she said she doesn't agree that there's a global war on terror, that it's a crime, and it should be treated as a crime. And what I've been saying to audiences for some time is, you know, yes, we are facing, you know, terrorists, just like Spain and England faced terrorists, and they dealt with them in civil processes and you know, put the transcripts on the internet in the case of Spain, but that we've got to understand that we've got, you know, if we lose our freedoms, we have worse enemies, we have worse problems than terrorism.
Well, terrorism is such an infinitesimal problem as compared to what we face from the federal government. And even when they killed like a million innocents in Iraq in response to what Osama bin Laden did. So this is, you know, hardly responsible. It's hardly appropriate. It's hardly a just war. It's, in fact, a very evil war, war of aggression. But that's, of course, been most of the U.S. wars throughout history have been wars of aggression to take away other people's freedoms, not to protect our freedoms.
Yeah, you're so right. You're so right. I learned, you know, with this last of the seven principles, principle seven is that the founders saw liberty as being a universal human right, not restricted to Americans. And they would have been, many of them would have been appalled at a situation that we've turned a blind eye to or tolerated of, you know, as long as we've got a semblance of a free society at home, we will tolerate or not oppose or not get too worked up about a foreign policy that since, you know, since 1898 has been sending our army on behest of corporate interests to subvert elected governments overseas or to install vicious dictators, you know, that do to our people exactly what we stood up to George III to prevent. I think that when people really complete their awakening, and again, I've got to credit Ron Paul for this because he said it more pithily than anyone I'd read. He said something like, you know, we should give up our empire and become a republic again. And I think there are many progressives who, you know, would heartily, heartily endorse that. That's one of those transpartisan things, you know, for us to wake up. It reminds me a lot of the middle of the 19th century when many white Americans woke up to just not being able to tolerate colluding with slavery, and they became really morally uncomfortable and uneasy, and that was good because they were facing truth. I think that we're starting to wake up to this very profound abandonment of our role as Americans, as supporters of freedom. You know, we kind of abandonment of this light we're supposed to support and embody, you know, in looking at our foreign policy and looking at how around the world, you know, we're sending our brave men and women to do the bidding of corporations and massacre people and put, you know, arrest journalists and, you know, disappear people, you know, again and again and again. And that's why some of the action steps at the end of the book are, you know, how to divest of, you know, of your empire. But, you know, some of the things you've said, I mean, I'm almost scared talking to you and the sort of particularly well-informed members of your community, because some of the theory that you offer makes things make sense that don't otherwise make sense. And here's what I mean. When you were talking about the Federal Reserve and kind of the recirculating of money from, you know, the bankers to the military-industrial complex to the politicians and so on, it's that cycle alone that explains, I mean, the Iraq War is a totally failed war as a matter of statecraft, but it's totally successful for laundering money. It's totally successful as a kind of, you know, high-level theft operation.
Sure. I mean, billions, as you've talked about, billions in cash disappeared.
Right.
And nobody even cares. Nobody cares about that. And, of course, then there have been sort of the open payoffs to Halliburton and all the rest of the companies connected with the government who were running the occupation, very vicious and immoral occupation in Iraq. So, yeah, there's a lot of money to be made out of government, out of quote-unquote public service.
Right, but it kind of explains the whole messaging around the war because, you know, one keeps being puzzled, well, this war is a disaster, but it doesn't see as statecraft, as, you know, saving lives, as installing democracy. But no one seems that bothered about it. And if really the goal is, you know, not that, but if the goal is this, you know, redirecting of, you know, trillions of dollars from point A to point B, that kind of makes it, it explains the kind of serenity with which, you know, this administration is throwing human beings into an inferno. I mean, it's a horrible, horrible, shocking conclusion, but it makes a kind of satanic sense. I mean, it actually explains some historical events. But boy, this is really challenging. It's very painful. So, okay, so why haven't people who share your viewpoint made more inroads in having prominent conservatives stand up and say, whoa, this is not what we meant?
Because prominent conservatives do mean what's happened. Because the conservative movement, I would argue largely, you know, for the last 50 years, has been an engine of fascism. It's been an engine of growth for the empire and for the war. So their rhetoric has not been that. But, you know, what else is new? They lie. But in actual fact, they've sought to bring about exactly this sort of operation. So, yeah, I mean, it's even in an earlier day. I mean, British, say, colonialism didn't make sense from the standpoint of the average person in England, let alone, of course, from the standpoint of the poor colonial citizen. But it made sense for the power elite and for the state. So the American empire, was it Chomsky who said that only Athens and America have had gigantic empires and pretended they didn't have an empire? You know, we have this empire that is a ripoff operation. It's about transfer of wealth. It's about redistribution of wealth from the average person to the people connected to the empire, to the all the big companies and the state itself and the military, and they're all doing very well. So indeed, all the government failures, whether we look at things like public schools or the Federal Reserve or the empire, they're failures from our standpoint, but they're not failures from the standpoint of the people who are ripping us off. They're
exactly
very happy about it.
Very happy. And I now believe, after going through this journey I went on of a kind of awakening, forgive me, liberty, that I actually think I now think the failure of the public schools, it serves them. You know, it serves these people in power to have a population of Americans who can barely read, who can't think critically, and, you know, half of whom, according to a number of studies entering college, don't know what our republic is supposed to look like. You know, they can't even recognize democratic processes, let alone recognize when they're being threatened, because civics is disappearing. Half of, I get that the way civics is taught is not, you know, adequate from your point of view or mine, but, you know, how much less adequate that half of American young people now don't get any civics at all. And so, you know, kids are being interviewed in surveys who now say that the First Amendment goes too far. It's when you completely disempower a population and let them forget their legacy as Americans and as patriots and what their rights and freedoms are and what the system is supposed to look like according to the framers, that you can manipulate them more easily. And they're like, what? Well, okay, you can deploy troops. I guess that makes sense. Or, well, gee, you can spy on me because I'm not doing anything wrong. It doesn't, I mean, one thing I really hoped to do with Give Me Liberty is to kind of awaken in people who are kind of slumbering that kind of alert, that American high alert, whoa, my freedom's about to get, you know, stepped on. This is not tolerable. Or, wow, you know, someone's calling this person who disagrees with them a traitor, a terrorist. That's not, you know, part of our core values, you know, that leads nowhere good. Or, you know, they're starting to purge the voter rolls that, you know, whether I'm a Republican or a Democrat or an independent, that is unacceptable. That's un-American. We need to reawaken those instincts in a hurry.
There's a reason that the federal government made sure that there are no courses in logic taught in any American public school. They want to stamp out independent thinking. They want to stamp out critical thinking. And, of course, they've succeeded in doing it.
You have evidence for that, that this is, I mean, it's not just been attrition?
Well, you know, there was a time that logic, part of it's dumbing down. But, yes, it began actually during the run-up to World War II, and then gradually continuing through the 50s and the 60s. You know, do I have an evidence that somebody gave an order? No. But did this result come about from increasing federal control of local schools? Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, no wonder. Boy, you're really explaining a lot of positions that I, as a progressive, have never fully understood. I never understood the hostility, you know, some other parts of the political spectrum toward the Department of Education. But if your point of view is that local control of education means that we can resist government intervention that might not be in the interests of an informed, you know, citizenry, that certainly makes sense. Wow. So
I mean, there's a reason. The reason the Department of Education wants to run every curriculum in America. I mean, there's a reason that they want to decide, because they want pro-state and stupido materials taught to the children.
Right.
So it's not a coincidence.
You are completely right. Oh wow. All right, we have our hands full. We have so much work to do.
Well,
it's extraordinary.
It sure has been great to have you on the show. And
thank
I want to
you.
Urge everybody to read The End of America, read the other books by Naomi Wolf, listen to her on YouTube, and I hope you'll be reading her on LouRockwell.com as well.
I will be honored to send you writing for the website, and it's been an absolute privilege to talk to you, and thank you so much for your patience in informing me about what I need to know.
Well, it's just been great to talk to you. Thank you. Thanks for all you're doing.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Lou Rockwell Show, produced by LouRockwell.com. The best-read libertarian website in the world. If you'd like to advertise on this podcast or on the website, email advertise@lourockwell.com. And thanks for listening.